You know, if you have any interest in remote viewing, and I know a lot of you do, well, this is certainly one of the top guys on the planet to hear from. And later in the show, I'll open up the phone lines and you'll get to talk with him and ask him your questions. But I'm delighted he's back with us. And Courtney, welcome back. We're glad to have you.
Kevin, it's great. It's my great pleasure again to be here and to be invited back. But I want to say something, Kevin. Do you know one of the great things about being on your show is you absolutely slam dunk have the best break music on any radio show anywhere. You really pick great. I mean, I've been really enjoying myself listening to the pre-show music and the break music. You've got a real artist. You've got a real art for it. And of course, you're also in a band yourself, so you know, this is part of your DNA, but still, it's, you really do pick good music.
Well, I'm glad you said that, and I've had a number of folks that have commented about that. You know, what I'm about to say is not a criticism of other shows. Every show does what they think is best, and I do what I think is best, but I just don't like music that, for this show, I don't want music that's sort of like ethereal and spooky and paranormalish, because to me that's sort of like doing a little mind control during the breaks, and I just don't like it, and never have,
you know,
done that.
There's another reason why that's a good point of view. The idea of the paranormal stuff like that is by almost its very name paranormal, not normal, and that's one of the big problems we have as a society. We've got to drop the whole idea that things that are new are abnormal and have to have spooky music associated with them. The reality is your type of music, good solid rock music and pop music, that's the type of music that's mainstream, and the ideas that we talk about on your show are mainstream, and things don't become what they are supposed to be unless you make them that way, unless you act as if they are that way. And you can't take a field and sort of say, I'm going to treat it as an abnormal thing until people treat me as normal. You have to treat yourself as normal, and normal people listen to great, great rock music, and you pick the best.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Okay, you got two new projects that we are going to talk about tonight, the Climate Project and the Atlantis Project, but I don't want to talk about those just yet. Before we get into those, I got some leftovers from last time you were with us, and we just ran out of time, you know, and I didn't get to ask these. One thing, you told us to, you know, that you were kind of looking at June and July of 2013. And I'm just wondering, is it unfolding as you think, as you saw it in your sessions and as you think it's supposed to?
Actually, that's really great, because that is our climate project. That's the big project that we did is in such an urgent need, or such an important need for people to understand.
Okay, well, we'll get into that then in just a minute, okay? Here's the next question. You had mentioned that you looked at, you were considering, well, okay, what is coming if the world leaders begin to accept the validity of remote viewing, as opposed to if they don't? And we just didn't have time for me to ask this, but that would imply that consciousness may somehow be able to change significantly the events from what were viewed in the remote viewing.
Okay, that's perfect. That also is regarding to our climate project. When I say the climate project, I'm really talking about exactly what you're talking about now.
Okay. Well,
it's a continuation. In fact, what it is an update of that conversation that we left off at.
Okay.
That you're referring to right now.
All right. One last question then.
Okay.
Let's say that the answer is yes, and that consciousness can change the event significantly from what were viewed. Okay, if that's the case, does that not give the people who are trying to get a particular future a motivation and platform for doing mind control on a mass level to try and form the consciousness they think will produce the effect they want?
Well, Kevin, that happens all the time now. That's the status quo.
Okay.
Because if you look at all the mainstream news outlets, all of them, New York Times, CNN, all the way up, all the way down, everything, all the, especially the U.S.-sponsored mainstream, the U.S.-based U.S. News stuff, what you see in there is not all the news that's fit to print, but all the news that's allowed to be printed.
Yeah.
And in my particular opinion. And so what you really get is a situation which they studiously ignore or don't publish anything that they don't want the masses sort of to rock and roll on. And they publish essentially crisis pieces. So if you look at CNN or the New York Times and you just look at the front page, you'll see crisis after crisis after crisis. What it is, it's an adrenaline shock to keep people fixated on one major horror after the next. And the idea is to keep people riveted onto that so that they don't look around. Now, the reality is these crises that are there really affect very few of the readers or the viewers of those web pages. So you can be hearing about some awful person that did some awful thing on CNN, for example, but the reality is there are zillions of things like that happening all over. That person's stuff really has no impact on you, but you're putting your consciousness into it. You're fixating on it. You're doorknobbing it. Mm-hmm. You're looking at it, and you're not letting your eyes get off of it, and that becomes what you think about. And as long as they can get you fixated on this crisis after crisis after crisis type of thinking, then you're not free intellectually to turn around and look at the other things and to sort things out. There's a theory, which I think we're going to eventually find out has more validity to it than most people think, that there may be an overlying idea about keeping the entire human species in a state of shock, in a state of crisis, one major thing after the next, so that we never really have time to settle down and look at each other and sort of sort things out. Mm-hmm. If you look at your life, Kevin, and everyone who's watching and listening to this show, look at your lives really. What crises do you really have that are really around you right now? So if you look at your lives, really all the stuff that you see on the news really doesn't relate to you. And there's a lot of news that could relate to you that you're not getting. You're getting all crisis stuff. Now, crises are not the only things that are happening in the world. The question you should be asking is, why is that the only thing that the news people are presenting to you? Mm-hmm. So why is that the thing that they're sort of slamming in front of your face? Well, look at the response. The response is that people get glued to it. So that's why. And so what we're having is a situation in which this so-called mind control is really a psychological thing, and it's difficult for me to say it's a conspiracy because I have no background or information that it's a conspiracy, but it acts as well orchestrated as it could possibly be. So it acts as if it's a conspiracy. Now, the idea of conspiracy was used and developed and sort of brought to its current state of laughdom, where people say, oh, that's a conspiracy. That happened during the JFK assassination. When John Kennedy was assassinated, the idea of conspiracy theory arose at that point. And that was to stop people from asking the question, because the Magruder film was very clear that it wasn't one person shooting one. I mean, the body was ricocheting back and forth. There were multiple shots. So the people in control didn't want people to ask questions, so they came up with one sole assassin who did absolutely everything. So the questions were there in front of everybody's face, but the authorities didn't want people to ask those questions. So to do that, they had to make it some type of psychological impediment to asking those questions. So they said it's a conspiracy theory. So conspiracists or conspiracy theory people are to be laughed at. And so that's where that all came about. It started at that point, mm-hmm. and it was extremely effective. And so when you look at the sort of history of not just the JFK stuff, but the UFO stuff, extraterrestrial life, it has spread throughout. And that is, whenever you hear people say something unusual, someone eventually looks at them and says, oh, you're a conspiracy nut. Well, the reality is nothing happens on this planet without two or more people thinking about how to do it. Nothing really happens alone. So there's all conspiracies. You go to lunch, you're having a conspiracy. You're saying, I'm going to go to lunch with two people. That's a conspiracy. So the idea of making people laugh at people who say that two or more people conspired to do something, that was well planned, and it was an extremely effective technique. It's much better and much more effective than shooting people that ask questions or blocking them up, because that causes controversy, making them a source of derision. And it's been so effective that to this day, there is no tenured professor anywhere that teaches the subject relating to psychic phenomena or remote viewing at any major university. There's no one that talks about the extraterrestrial life or UFOs. Those questions aren't even being raised. There aren't even people presenting papers about that at the major conferences. If you want to hear anything about extraterrestrial life or UFOs or anything like that, you have to go to a UFO conference, which has maybe 150 people in it. And it's isolated, it's blocked off, and that's exactly where the authorities want it. But you don't have it in any major university. Now, Kevin, let me ask you. This is a situation in which the universities are supposed to be bringing up the latest knowledge that there is. Well, isn't it really odd that among all of the tens of thousands of university professors, actually hundreds of thousands, none of them, raise these issues or any related issues at any major conference or in any classrooms in the entire country? I mean, that's what we're dealing with. And mm-hmm. I would dare say that it has spread into other countries as well. So it's pretty much the same elsewhere. So it's been an extremely effective technique, the technique of derision. And that's what this mind control thing is. It doesn't mean that you have radio waves beaming into people's heads. Is you set up a situation in which psychological responses occur if you raise certain issues. And if laughter or derision is part of that, it's an extraordinarily effective means of sort of boxing in the subjects that are actually raised.
It is. And but, you know, a rat in a laboratory, if he had the intelligence to do so, could absolutely stop the whole thing of being run through a maze every day. And the way is, if he takes a left, he gets to a room where he gets in the maze, where he gets a little shock in his feet. If he takes a right, he gets to the room that's got the cheese in it, and he gets rewarded. Well, if what he wants is the cheese, no matter what, okay, run through the maze and learn to turn right. If you're tired of running through the maze, go play like you like the electricity. And
he's a free thinking rat.
Yeah. If we do that, it breaks their power of mind control. And for instance, if you say, okay, you're going to laugh at me, you know what? There's lots of comedians making millions of bucks begging people to laugh at them. Go ahead, laugh at me. Just pay me. Yeah. Laugh at me. And just don't care that they laugh and don't care that they deride. And, you can take my approach and not be that laid back and just bite back.
Well, actually, it's even more important than that, because everything you said is true, but you're downplaying the importance of who you are. Mm-hmm. You're the rat that figured out the maze. Mm-hmm. And you're talking to all the other rats that figured out the maze, and we're all here listening. Mm-hmm. So you're actually talking to a very emancipated group of people, and you are a leader among the emancipated groups of people.
Talking to a bunch of rats, huh?
Yeah, the emancipated rats. Yeah. But the idea is that if the overall society, the planetary society, is to also experience that sense of liberation, it's going to spiral out from people like you. So it's not just that the rat broke the mentality, but right here we are the center, you are the center of that spiraling out that will eventually free everybody. You know, there was a bear in a zoo, and it was kept in a cage, and every day the only thing it did was walk up the one end of the cage, turn around, walk around to the other end of the cage, turn around, walk back to the other end of the cage, turn around, backward and forward for years. And eventually the zoo people and the town people got enough money to build a natural environment for the animals at the zoo, and they finally got the natural environment for the bear, which was a pool of water, trees and grass and so on like that. And then they had it all ready, and they opened the door, and they expected the bear to walk out. But what happened was the bear looked at the door that was open, and it just walked to one end of the cage, turned around, walked back to the other end of the cage, turned around, walked back. Meaning it kept on doing it, because the prison wasn't the bars.
It was right
here. The prison was the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are in that habit, it is not that somebody's holding a gun against your head and forcing it. When you're in that habit, everyone is their own prison guard.
Okay.
And so, what you're doing actually with your show is talking to the bear and trying to coax it out.
All right, we have to step away for a break for just a moment. Yeah, but you are right. And the door is open. All you have to do is just walk through it. But you have to recognize that the door is open. And, the open door is, who cares what those other people think about you? They don't pay your bills. So let them laugh, you know. Just be real. At the beginning of our talk this evening, Dr. Brown, I had mentioned some questions that I had. And you said that those are really part of this new project, the Climate Project. Why don't we dive into that? What's that all about?
Well, actually, the Climate Project is what we've been dealing with since 2008, when we started it, where we were trying to discern what we thought was going to be minor climatic change between June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013. And it was variously labeled a Climate Project, which was its official name, but also the Earth Changes Project and things like that, because what we got, to our great surprise, was very huge, significant Earth changes, which was major climatic changes in locations all over the planet. And we had all the squeakiest of clean of experimental designs, with total randomization, public verification of the data process. And fundamentally, it was connected to our research involving multiple timelines or multiple realities, parallel universes. So what we basically did was had data that suggested huge climatic changes before June 3rd, or right around June 1st, 2013, and also what appeared to be some type of meteor events that would affect the planet before June 1st, 2013. And some of the meteor events that we were seeing were indicating that some of the impacts would be in the oceans, causing large tsunamis or displacement waves that would affect some coastal areas. So this was all done in 2008, and we published it. And so we were talking about what this stuff could possibly be. And then what happened was, sure enough, the climate of the planet started to go absolutely bonkers. I mean, this has been the most violent and wackiest weather in my life. It's right off the scale. Apparently, the United Nations is going to come out with a report. Its initial draft version apparently is so shocking that they said it's going to scare the wits out of everybody. And it was published in The Economist, parts of it. But apparently it's going to be coming out in September or October. But the authorities now have a chance to sort of tone it down. So it may come out much more mild. But anyway, it says basically the climate has just gone bonkers. I mean, we have some of the most violent weather that we've had ever. But in addition, we were looking for something significant involving meteors. Now, remember, we were talking fundamental to our research is the idea of multiple timelines or multiple realities.
And in the research
that I published, I've argued strongly that in a situation of multiple realities, multiple versions of us break off at every moment of the now. So there is no one future for anything. There is only a branching that occurs. So that's why it's impossible to predict. Impossible, not difficult, but impossible to predict in a deterministic manner any one future, because there is no any one future. But there should be some commonalities across a large swath of futures, and we said that there should be something in our, there's something in our data that said that there should be some type of meteor events prior to June 1st, 2013. Okay, so what happened in mid-February 2013 is that there were two, in fact, completely almost unprecedented meteor asteroid events that affected the planet within the first, within 24-hour period. There was a large asteroid, DA14, that almost hit the planet. It was within a whisker away. And we had a large meteor, impact over Russia in mid-February 2013. Mm-hmm. So on February 16, 2013, I issued another report, an update, an initial update on the climate project, saying that those two things met in a multiple universe concept. They met our expectations with respect to the climate project, and thus no new, since those are so rare, CNN in fact said it was 100 million to one odds that both the Russian meteor and DA14 could have happened within the same 24-hour period. So those are such rare things, I said, we should not expect anything further before June 1st, and thus the impacts of those things on oceans causing tsunamis and things like that would not occur. So I issued that on 16th of February 2013, you know, well before June 1st, 2013. Now, what basically happened was that much of the public doesn't really understand the idea of multiple realities, of parallel universes. What the public sees is a prediction, that wasn't a prediction, but a description of remote viewing sessions, and says, oh, what we're expecting is major meteors crashing into the oceans, wrecking the coastlines, and if that doesn't happen, remote viewing is bonkers. Well, that's the type of misunderstanding you get when you have public projects. People, they want to be their own armchair scientists. I mean, it doesn't make sense to say that we are having an actual scientific project involving multiple timelines, and then for people to disregard our entire theory and say, well, you know, if it doesn't happen exactly the way it says, you know, in the remote viewing data, then remote viewing is bonkers. This is a very complicated existence or reality that we work in. The reality is those meteor asteroid events were extremely rare, and we were expecting some type of meteor events before June 1st that would be very, very rare and potentially devastating. Now, what about this? You know, let's take a look at what actually did happen. This addresses your other question, which is about intervention. Can people change the future? One of the things that happened after the Russian meteor of mid-February was that there was a video that was uploaded, actually a few videos that were uploaded, but there was a major video that was uploaded, because there's video cameras everywhere these days, of some people in Russia recording the meteor coming down and streaking over the sky. And clear as day, something came from behind the meteor and impacted the meteor, hitting it from behind, fragmenting it, shooting pieces of it far into the front of it. And from the video evidence alone, it's clear that something came from behind and hit it. Now, there's only three possibilities. It can be another meteor, but the chances of another meteor hitting that meteor from behind with that much of a sharpshooter is so astronomically small that you might as well just disregard it. But that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the U.S. and the Russians presumably have some type of forms of anti-ballistic missile systems, and it could have been shot at by that. But in order for that to happen with a meteor that was coming in so quickly, the authorities with their secret anti-ballistic missile system would have had to have been ready. The guns would have had to have been drawn, the triggers cocked, everything ready to go. And then the question would be, why would they have been ready? Well, we know that the military and other areas of the government do look at our web pages and do actually follow our results. The former military remote viewers, the major trainers on the planet, like Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan, they're on our board of directors. I mean, we're not a secret to the military. They follow what we do. And what basically happens is that if we report something like that major is going to happen, or in our data, they will act on it. And so if it was an anti-ballistic missile system that hit the meteor, I guarantee you, if they had seen these results, they're not going to sit around and do nothing. They're going to do whatever they can do to be ready for it, to try to capture it. And that's what was captured on the video. Something came from behind, smacked into the meteor, fragmenting it. If it had not done that, it would have impacted Russia solidly and created a nuclear explosion, or the equivalent of a nuclear explosion, that was at least 50 times greater than that which impacted Hiroshima. It would have produced an explosion 50 times worse than the nuclear explosion that destroyed Hiroshima at the end of World War II. So the other third possibility is that it was extraterrestrial involvement that fragmented that meteor. Now, if we do not have the anti-ballistic missile systems to do this, well, one of the worst kept secrets on this planet is that there is, involvement between the U.S. government and presumably the Russians or perhaps some others with some extraterrestrial species. Now, I'm not going to get into that, but let's just take that as a given, that that is true and that will eventually become worldwide known and accepted. It's already accepted by approximately 80% of the public in the United States and probably equivalently elsewhere, but it'll eventually make the New York Times and CNN and stuff like that. So if that's true, then if the military did see our climate project results for 2013, it's absolutely guaranteed that they would have turned to their extraterrestrial contacts and said, hey, look, if this is happening, stop it. I mean, they're sharing things. They're sharing technology transfer stuff for other things that the extraterrestrials are interested in. And they would have definitely looked at them and said, hey, look, intervene with this thing, stop this thing. So that could have been one of the reasons that the asteroid, that the meteor was hit, could have been an extraterrestrial thing. The fact that it was hit was very clear. Now, the other thing is that DA-14 almost hit us. That's an asteroid. And had that hit us, it would have hit us from the southern hemisphere, it would have fragmented, it would have produced large tsunamis that would have exactly matched the worst of our remote viewing data. And it's absolutely a piece of cake for extraterrestrials to nudge that thing so that it would not hit the planet. So that's, if they intervened with respect to the Russian meteorite, then they clearly would have intervened with respect to DA-14. So the reality is, if our remote viewers did see this stuff, unusual meteor activity, and they bring that information back, That's how multiple timelines work. Meaning, in one version of us, those impacts did happen. In one version of us, DA14 did hit the planet. Because that's what the remote viewers saw. They saw something like that, hitting the planet, hitting the water in the southern hemisphere particularly, causing these large tsunamis. And in another version of us, that information was seen and it was acted on to prevent that. Now, for many people, the idea of multiple realities is more difficult to accept than the idea of extraterrestrial life or the idea of remote viewing. But it's one of the most important discoveries of the remote viewing phenomenon that this, all the evidence points to the fact that multiple versions of us can coexist without bumping into each other. I'm not talking about one or two other versions. Essentially, an infinite variety of versions of us can coexist without bumping into each other. Now, people then say, well, how could that possibly be? Well, the reality is we're talking about a completely new level of physics that's going to have to be discovered and unraveled and understood. This is not something that's just going to be just accepted point blank. The person, the physicist who originally came up with this to explain quantum phenomena that were at the time unexplainable was Hugh Everett in 1957. And when he published a short version of his dissertation in a major physics journal, Bryce DeWitt, a very famous physicist at the time, wrote to him and said, you know, this is all very interesting. No one questioned the mathematics that Hugh Everett was bringing up. Hugh Everett studied under at the Department of Physics at Princeton University under John Wheeler. And Bryce DeWitt said, no one's questioning the mathematics, but the conclusion, the interpretations that you're talking about, which is a generalization of quantum mechanics, of this branching, of this multiple realities, of the worlds branching off at every moment of the now, that's just not happening. I'm looking at myself. It's just not happening.
So as we went away for break, Dr. Brown, you were talking about, the guy says, not arguing with the math here.
Yeah.
But
well,
my experience doesn't match it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, that was a famous physicist, Bryce DeWitt, who was extraordinarily brilliant, who was arguing with Hugh Everett, the guy who discovered the multiple realities interpretation. And Hugh Everett said, you know, his response was, you know, this is very similar to the debates that surrounded Copernicus. When Copernicus was saying that the Earth revolved around the Sun, it wasn't the other way around, that the Sun was revolving around the Earth. And people at the time said, that's so stupid, are you serious? Look up at the sky, obviously the Sun's moving, we're not moving, I don't feel us moving, we're steady, we're rock solid. The Sun is flying around out there, going up and down every day. And so that was before Newton, before the whole understanding of Newtonian mechanics, understanding of momentum. They didn't understand that they would have been part of a moving system and would not felt any movement because there would have been no change in their angular velocity. There would have been no change in the movement that they would have been experiencing. So they didn't understand it. So Bryce DeWitt acknowledged by saying, touche, that's a good argument. Meaning there's a whole new realm of physics that has to be discovered that goes beyond relativistic and Newtonian physics to understand how this stuff will occur. We have
Let me throw something in right here, because I think we'll be hearing.
Yeah.
I think we're going to hear this eventually. I'm not going to use his name. Very famous physicist. I was in a conversation with him, a private conversation. We were talking about how quantum physics seems to be getting really more into what people used to call spiritual things. And he said, that's correct, and we may need to call it spizzix. So we may start hearing, if you hear someone start calling it spizzix, you'll know who I was talking to.
Yeah, that's where it's very clear that the idea of consciousness has been separated out from mainstream physics, mainstream science. And the whole idea of there being a non-local aspect of consciousness have been separated out. So the whole idea of spirituality, non-local consciousness, psychic stuff, has been ripped from a mainstream understanding of physics. And we're strictly materialistic in our conventional way of looking at science and what's taught in the university. And that's going to have to change, because it's clearly wrong. And it came about because of a bizarre sort of historical sort of evolution of thinking, a series of events that occurred. But it's the way it is now, and it's going to have to change. And the spiritual people will have to learn more about physics, and the physics people are going to have to learn more about spirituality and or consciousness. And basically, even long ago, John Wheeler understood this in essence when he said, nothing really happens on the level of the quantum, and on the quantum level, without observation or recognition of some type. Meaning, you have to observe something for it to occur. You have to have some type of interaction with it for it to occur on the quantum level, or it simply doesn't happen. Now, the real problem has always been the generalization of quantum mechanics up to the macro level, the level of you and I. And so the physicists have this idea that there's an imaginary line called the line of decoherence, and everything on one side of it stays in the quantum realm, and everything on the other side is in the classic realm. And the things are separate, and they have separate laws for the two realms. But it's so stupid, because obviously it's unsupportable. Everything in the macro realm is based on stuff of the quantum realm. So you can't have just an imaginary line that separates the two. But that's the way we are at the state of the science right now. But that's going to change. Hugh Everett's understanding of the multiple reality version of us and having other worlds coexisting, that's actually a rage among young physicists these days. But they're untenured, or they're just recently tenured, or they're graduate students. It's going to take a while for that to really replace the old-timers that are really stuck with ideas that they were introduced to when they were in graduate school. They have to literally retire and go away for these ideas to sort of really hit the mainstream. But it's going to happen without any doubt.
All right, so let's talk about the climate project in terms of the climate itself. I don't exist in a vacuum. None of us do. And so all day long, no matter what else I've got going on, my telephone rings. If I'm here in the studio when the telephone rings, I answer it. And people are talking to me literally from around the world. And so I have heard all this year, actually beginning late last year, how the weather is just weird and unbelievable where they are.
It's crazy.
Now, it's not that way in every spot. I mean, there are places where things are pretty much like they have been. But
it's only temporary, Kevin. Meaning, in those places where things are seemingly the same, if you wait just a few weeks or a month, things change in those areas as well and go back to seemingly normal in the places that were horrific a month ago. Mm-hmm. So it's a constantly changing thing. You know, there's a website that Daz Smith, who's one of the remote viewers of our climate project, he's one of the best remote viewers of the planet, he created to catalog and sort of log in over the last couple of years climate change as we've gotten into 2013. And the website's called www.climatechange2013.com. So it's climatechange2013.com. And there's a section on it, and one of the banners, it's just called News. And so people should just go to the News section, where he just lists page after page after page of the crazy things that have been happening. And you can see the dates are like close to each other. So in China, for example, they had extreme flooding, the worst in 50 years. There was heavy rains in Alberta, for example, forcing Calgary to evacuate. There was Holland, there was floods, unbelievable floods all throughout Europe. I mean, it's just this summer has been completely bonkers for all of the main countries in Europe, Germany, Belgium. I mean, it's just been crazy. The rivers are overflowing. there was a flood death toll in India because of the rain, and entire villages were being washed away in India. I mean, and they have pictures of these villages just literally flowing down the river, I mean, with major apartment buildings collapsing right into them. We had experts warning us, climatic experts all over the world, from the National Weather Service, for example. The Louis Uccellini, who's the director of the National Weather Service, says, we're seeing an increase in the extreme events and increase in damage associated with them as we've become more vulnerable. So it's just been one thing after the next. Germany evacuating major areas, floods swamping Europe, and this goes on page after page after page. And of course, you get back a little further, you're dealing with this unbelievable tornadoes that you had in Oklahoma. This type of stuff didn't exist in 2008. And it was not predictable by any meteorologist in 2008. And our climate project said, oh, blankety blank's going to hit the fan around 2013, and it has. And it also said there's going to be some meteor events.
Would you like a radio version of that?
A video version of what?
No, a radio version of the blankety blank is going to hit the fan.
I liked it so that don't have to go through it and edit it and put bleeps.
Yeah,
so
the manure is going
to help you out here, Kevin.
The manure is going to hit the ventilator.
Okay,
you can say that on any radio station.
That's a great radio version of it.
Yeah.
And so the basic idea is that the climate project was really dead on. And so the actual remote viewing data has details in it that sometimes don't match exactly what happened in specific places, but that's exactly what you're supposed to get. Exactly what you're supposed to get in a multiple reality version of an understanding of the project, which is how the project started in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to get tremendous correspondence, and the correspondence we got was climate that's gone bonkers and meteor events before June 1st, 2013. And that's exactly what we got. Climate that's gone bonkers in a completely unpredictable way from the perspective of 2008. 5 years down the line, we predicted climate that's gone bonkers and meteor events before June 1st, and that's exactly what we've gotten. And so that is, you know, the climate project didn't fail. It was great. It exceeded our expectations. It was spectacular. So those people who get sort of upset and say, but the details weren't exactly right, well, I'm telling you,
they just don't understand how it works.
Sort of the similar type of thing happened in that as well. So I am not saying that any scientists or group or institution was corrupted in order to corrupt the data for Google Earth. All I'm saying is I personally don't believe any authorities when they dismiss something and they say, this is a picture, and they say, you know, dismiss it. I mean, if I was the type of person that let other people do my thinking for me, I wouldn't be the leading academic studying the remote viewing phenomenon in the first place. I mean, the people back in the mainstream was saying remote viewing doesn't even exist. Trust me. And if I was the person to be influenced by people that said stuff like that, I wouldn't have done anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at this and I said, this is perfect. So we finished up our project, and we had two of the very best remote viewers on the planet Earth, Dick Allgaier and Deborah Duggan Takagi of the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, trained by Glenn Wheaton out of Special Forces. And we had seven targets, and we went in, and under totally squeaky clean, super blind conditions, the viewers went in. We have video made of live sessions, and it was really great. And we found out the entire story. We know about what happened.
We want to hear that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. What basically happened is long ago, and it wasn't very long ago, probably around 70,000 years ago, there was a major version of us, meaning a human civilization that was technologically advanced, and they weren't destroyed by a natural cataclysm. They destroyed themselves. They were drilling into the earth to, they already had an incredibly good source of energy that was crystalline-based, like some type of crystalline-based energy reactors they were using, but they were going after more. They were going after the core of the Earth. They were drilling deeply into the core. And we have the pictures, we have the sketches, unbelievably good sketches. It's very clear. All the stuff is up on our website. And what they basically did is they popped... The whole planet is a balloon. It's an 8,000-mile diameter balloon with an 8-mile crust on it. And if you pop it, it pops and it crinkles the balloon. And what basically happened is they drilled these big holes in it trying to go after the heat in the interior. And they blew a hole in the side of the Earth, basically the size of Australia, and the crust buckled. And that's why the huge anomaly... it was a civilization that was off the coast of Morocco in Spain. It sunk and is now 3 miles down. And they knew what was happening. They had a few days warning because they actually saw. We have the sketches of them looking at their computer monitors. They couldn't believe their eyes. They realized what they did. They sent their civilian leader, surrounded by military people, to special bunkers. Nobody survived. Actually, very few people survived. The geneticists actually know this because everyone on our planet today are related to the same approximately 2,000 pairs. 2,000 pairs, that's like 4,000 pairs, 4,000 people. 2,000 to 4,000 pairs of people who were breeding, who survived the cataclysm about 70,000 years ago. That's how we can date this, because the geneticists have figured out that there was a bottleneck in human history. About 70,000 years ago, something volcanic happened on the planet that killed everybody except for about 2,000 to 4,000 surviving pairs of people. And everybody on the Earth, everybody from the Aborigines, people in Africa, people in Europe, people in America, South America, everyone is related to the exact same 2,000 to 4,000 surviving pairs of people that survived that cataclysm. You can look it up, the cataclysm, on Wikipedia, for example. It's often referred to as Toba catastrophe theory, T-O-B-A, and that is in reference to Lake Toba in Indonesia. Now, we don't have to decide whether Indonesia was anywhere near where the volcanic thing popped, but the point is that the scientists are looking for a volcanic event that affected the entire planet 70,000 years ago and killed off everybody but 2,000 to 4,000 or 5,000 pairs of people. And that's exactly what our data show. And it's so incredibly clear. And, you know, things don't survive the geological record very easily. 70,000 years is a lot of time in terms of things to survive. We have trouble recovering things that are 3,000 or 4,000 years old in the Middle East and figuring out what happened. So if you're talking 70,000 years, it's very difficult for things to survive. But on the bottom of the ocean, we have a very clear anomaly. We did the remote viewing on it. Now, the data are available for free. The pictures are available for free. But it was a complicated story. So what we did is we came out with a DVD that captures and presents everything, including having a live session with Dick Allgaier on it. So you can actually see him under totally blind conditions describing this thing. It's riveting. And that DVD is our Atlantis project, and it's called Atlantis, The True Story. And this, if you really want to know what the history of us are, forget what you learn in the school about civilization being a very recent thing over the last few thousand years. It's just not true. If you really want to know what happened, you know, watch in your own eyes with unbelievably clear pictures done under squeaky clean conditions what the last few days were like the last time we had a major technological civilization. This isn't some alien civilization at some distant planet on another galaxy. This is us right here. And secrecy cloaked science destroyed our world once, and it can do it again. That's the other reason why we have to know our history. You know, this planet, Kevin, if I can just sort of mention it, one of the things that people really don't understand about our planet is this. You look at the planet Earth and you say, this is so optimal, this is so great, this is why the extraterrestrials want to be here, because we've got so much good stuff here. They don't understand. This is not a good planet to have a major civilization on. This is not a planet for people to live on. This planet is a really good biological, it's a botanical and zoological paradise. But we have major disasters that occur that wipe off civilizations before they even get a chance to start. We're living on an 8-mile thick crust of a huge molten balloon of liquid rock. I mean, the entire planet is liquid rock, and we're on a thin crust on top of that. Plus, we have major, if you look at books like from Robert M. Schock, who is a geophysicist out of Boston University, where he talks about past civilizations being destroyed by solar events. We have major things that disrupt. We have pole shifts that happen on this planet. I'm not talking geographical pole shifts with the North Pole and the South Pole physically switched. Now, I'm not talking about that. But we have magnetic pole shifts, and this is not in dispute, where the North Pole becomes the South Pole and South Pole becomes the North Pole in terms of magnetic compass. And that when that happens, that disrupts all types of stuff in the interior. Huge earthquakes, volcanic stuff. The climate is wacky. The air is very volatile. It's a very difficult place to have a long-term civilization that can be around for hundreds of thousands and millions of years, which is what a civilization really needs. Basically, something happens to sort of throw us into a complete turmoil every, 10, 15, 20,000 years. So, if, for example, you look at the major ruins in Turkey, there have major ruins in Turkey that are incredible building structures that were intentionally buried. Robert Schock, in some of his work, talks about that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of the anomalies that occurred in Easter Island, it's very clear that ancient civilizations used to bury themselves under tons of rock to protect themselves from stuff. And that's because stuff happens. It really disrupts our planet. So in this case, the Atlantis anomaly was a situation not in which the sun did anything. That happens at other times. This is a situation where we did it. We blew ourselves up. And It will eventually be taught in the universities. But for right now, you can get it right here. And you help us out with our projects when you do it.
All right, I want to open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to join the conversation. And if you have a question or a comment, please pick up your telephone and dial 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, we have an additional option for you, and that option is for you to go to the website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show, and then right above that picture is a link that says outside USA or Canada, and there's a link. You click that, it says flash message, so you can participate that way. And we do have a flash message right here from Costa Rica. This is from Carl Nichols in Costa Rica. Courtney, what happened to all that water that was going to be splashing around?
Okay, well, Carl, you may have missed the first hour of the show. That was what we were talking about with the Climate Project. And that was also what we were talking about. If you wanted to get the updates for that, that explained that, you needed to sign up for our free newsletter, which you get from our website. At the bottom of the nav bar on the left, your big banner says subscribe to our free newsletter. Because in mid-February, February 16th, 2013, when the big meteor events happened over Russia, and with the asteroid DA14 all happening within the same 24-hour period, we announced that satisfied our meteor data. And in a multiple reality sense of the world, which we talked about extensively in the first hour of the show, you have to understand there are going to be tremendous variations.
Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, yes, and Dr. Brown, You know, I am completely down with the reality of multiple dimensions. You know, I know it to be a fact experientially. And I used to think I was nuts until I encountered the work of Kurt Gödel, you know, the mathematician, who in his incompleteness theory had drawn a total picture, lending total credence to there being multiple dimensions, you know, existing simultaneously. And, you know, that was so reassuring to me. Having said that, let me just throw this out there. When you're in the business of making predictions, having multiple dimensions is a real convenience. It's kind of like having several rugs you can sweep stuff under if it doesn't come true. You say, well, it happened in that dimension, not this one. We predicted it, and it happened in the other dimensions. You know, and that kind of, to me, invalidates it's tricky, though. I understand you're working with a technology that's kind of cutting edge. A lot of people aren't, you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the whole field of physics right now is so owned by what the Rockefellers will allow. It's hemmed in by this bogus thing called quantum physics, which is a complete illegitimate child of Immanuel Kant's critique of pure reason, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there are other fields and other lenses you can look through to see what's going on so much more clearly. Rassilian physics.
Okay, let's let me cut to the chase here with regard to what you're talking about. First of all, I'm a mathematician, so I work a lot with quantum mechanics, and I like quantum mechanics a lot. So the issue that I've been raising is what we need is a generalization of quantum mechanics to the macro level. However, let me address what you were talking about earlier, which was the idea that differences between the actual descriptions that are found by the remote viewers in details with respect to what actually happens invalidates the study and sweeps it under the rug with the multiple universes sort of explanation. That is not what's going on here, because what I've said very clearly from the very beginning, even going back to 2008, is that there will be major differences in the details because of the multiple reality stuff. But what we should do is see major correspondences in the big stuff. And that's exactly what we got. We got stuff that was totally unpredictable on the level of meteorology and asteroids and meteors in the year 2008. And we described those things accurately, major meteor events happening to the Earth, as well as major climatic changes happening to the Earth by June 1st, 2013. That was not predictable in terms of the general stuff. But you must understand, the multiple realities issue is not something we can easily walk away from. Just because it exists, you can't use it, or other people can't use it, as an excuse to say, now remote viewing is invalid. On one hand, you started out your statement by saying, I'm all down with the understanding of multiple realities, how it can actually occur. And then you went right away to saying, but this invalidates your study because the details were incorrect, and because you're using multiple realities. You can't have it both ways. If there are multiple realities, it will be impossible, not difficult, but impossible to deterministically describe details in the future. The only thing you'll be able to describe is huge, major things that have an obvious correspondence. And in the things that we described, which is major climatic changes plus meteor events, those were extraordinarily rare and totally unpredictable 5 years in advance. And that shows that we are having some major correspondence between our data and the actual sort of facts on the ground. So what I'm saying is that this is one study among a great many studies that need to be done. studying the issues of multiple realities. We're just at the beginning of understanding how this is done. We're not talking about this being a definitive study and no need to think about it. And that's what mainstream science says. They come out with one study and they say this is definitive and so you don't need to worry about it anymore. Just accept what we say, trust us. And then, you know, 6 months, 2 years later, whatever, they come out with a new study and say, okay, those results are not correct, these are correct, this is definitive, and so on. Well, we don't play that game. What we say is that this is a study that we've got. It was based on the understanding of there being multiple realities, which actually we studied in detail in another project called the Multiple Universes Experiment. And the data and the experiment was published in a leading peer-reviewed scientific journal, the Journal of Scientific Exploration. And for people that want to actually see that study, you can actually see it on our website if you go to farsight.org, www.farsight.org, because we're a nonprofit, and go to the home page and click on, go down a little bit into the middle where it says a brown banner saying latest peer-reviewed published research, and you can see the article that describes all that stuff dealing with the multiple realities. So what we have with your question and with the question that preceded you, with the previous person, is the same thing we've been dealing with for the longest time, where the public sees these complexities and says, okay, I understand this, but then the details weren't correct, so I'm invalidated, so the study must be invalidating. Now, this is one of the reasons why most scientists, almost all scientists except myself, don't like to do public experiments, because the public so easily misunderstands these things. For example, I just spent an hour plus explaining the multiple realities version, and then the person who came in with a question before you said, so where did all the splashing go? they asked about the details, as if I hadn't spent an hour plus talking about it beforehand. That's what happens. The public is it's very challenging to try to educate the public on these complicated things. If I were to act like other scientists, I would simply not tell you anything about it. You wouldn't see me or hear me on the Kevin Smith Show or anywhere else, and I would just say everybody out there is a bunch of idiots and I'm not going to explain it to you. But that's not what it is. You're smart, but the scientists, you've been conditioned by scientists sort of telling you expect definitive answers and just accept what we have. And so you're expecting definitive answers and accept what they have. But if you look at the scientists, every 6 months to a couple of years, they're changing their definitive answers. They don't understand reality any more than anyone else does. And what the big mistake is for them to present their information as if it's definitive, when in fact they don't have anything definitive. For example, our Atlantis project. If you go to any major university, they'll tell you that civilization is a brand new thing, happened within the last 3,000 years. And like you go to the major ruins inside Turkey, for example, that date back 10,000-12,000 years, that was obviously a major civilization that purposely buried themselves to protect themselves from something. You know, something's got to be wrong. And if you look at our Atlantis project, it goes back 70,000 years and you had a high-tech civilization. And so what you're basically getting is just that's the definitive type of quality that mainstream science uses to present their information to you is not correct. I would like to say fraudulent, but it's not like they're purposely cheating. They're deceiving themselves. They are deluded themselves. And when you actually come to us and say, why aren't you actually having that level of definitiveness that mainstream science offers us, I'm looking back at you and saying, that's the problem. you're trying to reinterpret everything as a definitive way, and it's not that way.
You misinterpreted what I said. You put words into my mouth I did not say. I did not say that just because some of the details didn't come true that you said were coming true, that invalidates remote viewing. I neither said that, nor did I think it. You know, remote viewing is still very valid. You know, so that's number one. Number two, you're assuming that I'm buying into the mainstream scientific flow when I stated clearly that the entire mainstream scientific flow is owned, you know, by the paradigm that's currently running our little strip of reality here. And there are other realms of physics, for instance, that from Walter Russell, that from Paul LaViolette, that from Tom Campbell, as well as a lot of the work done by many mathematicians, including Kurt Gödel. And as far as I'm concerned, those abstract mathematicians are the guys that really have it going on. You know, they're opening up fields of possibilities. If people choose to program themselves and not be programmed, either by the mainstream scientists or the alternative scientists, you know,
yeah, no, Steve, let me say that you're correct about something here. It sounded like I was attacking you, but I really wasn't. You have to understand, we're on a radio show that's broadcast all over the world. And what I have to do when someone calls
in... Hang on just a second. Both of you, you're talking right on top of each other.
Yeah, yeah. So, Steve, hold on for a second. So let me respond to what you're saying. You're correct in noting that it seemed to, that I was attacking you, but in reality I wasn't. We're on a major radio show that broadcasts all throughout the world. And when somebody calls in like yourself, I have to use you as an example to make a general point. So while I understand what you're saying, and you know, I sympathize with the idea that you're not buying into the mainstream stuff, there is nonetheless something that I have to get across to the rest of the audience, and you happen to be here, and you happen to offer a very interesting and an opportune moment for me to sort of jump back in to try to emphasize the understanding that the masses misinterpret science very easily, and I have to get back to that because the understanding of multiple realities is one of the most fundamentally difficult understandings that that all of us are going to have to get our head around, including mainstream physicists. And I brought up the idea of Bryce DeWitt interacting with Hugh Everett earlier in the show to show you that even really, really, really smart physicists like Bryce DeWitt had a very difficult time with it. And probably, you know, all throughout his life, he probably never really accepted that understanding that Hugh Everett offered. So it's just really challenging, and I've got to use every opportunity I have to try to get back to it, and you were convenient. So I apologize if it sounded like I was attacking you. The reality was I was very grateful that you were raising those points the way you raised them.
But the thing is, you know, the important thing, and multiple realities it's an empiric fact for those who have experienced it, you know, and it's a theoretically provable, mathematically provable fact for people who understand that realm of mathematics, you know. But when you start stepping into realms that are so outside the common experience, it's easy to for the public to find reasons to jettison the whole idea.
All right. Steve, thanks for the call, man. I have to run. We've got a break taking over. Very, very interesting stuff, don't you think? Now, during that break, and actually during your conversation with Steve from Georgia about multiple realities, parallel realities, alternate realities, it goes by a lot of different names, I thought of a question. So I got to ask it, and here it is. When we talk about these parallel realities or multiple realities or alternate realities, however we term it, are they potential or kinetic in nature? In other words, it's a reality that potentially could happen, or is it happening?
It's the second. It's very important to understand that all of these multiple realities are equivalent to our own, and they're equally as real as our own. There's no difference between them. And there are multiple versions of ourselves. Now, let me explain how this happens, because many people are going to listen to that and say, okay, that's ridiculous. This is really going off the deep end. But this is what it means. Physicists have never found anything solid in the universe. Nothing. You can say, well, the planet is solid, my computer is solid, my car is solid. It's not true. It's all empty space. All you have when physicists burrow into that is they find molecules and then atoms, and then inside that, subatomic particles, and then when they take those subatomic particles and blast away at them with atomic atom smashers. All they find is smaller and smaller things. They have never, ever, ever found anything that's a solid billiard ball type of thing that cannot be divided. It doesn't exist. The only thing that they have found is energy. E equals mc squared. C squared, the speed of light squared, is a constant, so energy equals mass. So the idea is that the only thing that they have found is energy, which is equivalent to mass. And the energy expresses itself in terms of waves. And when waves interact among themselves, they group together in phenomenon known as wave packets. And that's where waves interact with properties of constructive and destructive interference. And that can be understood in terms of a piano. If you go to a piano and bang on middle C and then bang on the B key right next to it, you'll hear two notes that are very close to each other, and they will produce a beat frequency where they interact with and interfere with each other, and it sounds like wah, 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 wah. Well, if you take that middle C and bang it again and then bang on the highest B on the entire keyboard, there will also be constructive and destructive interference, but it won't be something you can really notice. So in order for it to be something noticeable, the frequencies have to be pretty close to each other. So when frequencies are relatively close, they interfere with each other and produce these blips in the fabric of space-time. And these blips are what they call realms or areas in which particles exist. Now, the particles don't actually really exist, as John Wheeler said, until they're observed in some way, until they're registered in some way, until they hit a photographic plate or something like that. So the reality is the early interpretation of quantum mechanics, so-called Copenhagen interpretation, says basically that solid stuff materializes out of a probabilistic ether of energy waves when it's observed. Well, that's just stupid. As Hugh Everett once said, it's a monstrosity of an interpretation of quantum mechanics. The reality is that when anything happens, including us, we are built up from subatomic particles, which are essentially just energy packets that are aggregated up into subatomic particles, atoms, molecules, cells, bones, muscles, brains, big things. And so when we have, so we're actually large ensembles of superpositions, or these wave packets that sort of build up. And what we see when we look out in the world are things that are in sync with us, meaning the frequencies have to be fairly close to each other for us to actually see them, in order for the superposition to actually work. So anything that's out of sync or too far away in frequency, we simply can't see, and it passes right through us. So the reason we can remote view is human brains are essentially extremely complex hologram generators. And what that means is they screen out all frequencies except for one collection that gives you a picture of the reality that you see in front of you. And they screen out everything else. It works exactly like a radio, where there are many stations broadcasting on a band of the radio, say the AM band or the FM band, and you don't hear them. Why? Because the radio is designed to select out only one frequency at a time and to put that frequency on the speakers so you hear your favorite rock band playing. That's what our brains do to this reality. They select out a set of frequency that presents our world to us. Remote viewers work because they train to get the brain to allow in certain frequencies that are normally screened out. So that's why remote viewing is trainable. It's trainable because you can eventually get the brain to cooperate to let certain things in that it otherwise screens out by paying attention to something, to things. And so it takes a long while to get really good at it. But when you get good at it, you're ready to play in Carnegie Hall. I mean, it's you're really good. And so that's how these multiple realities coexist. They coexist because they're not solid in the first place. They don't bump into one another. It's not like there's multiple versions of Jupiter and they'd crash into one another and create an explosion. No, no. What happens is everything is a reflection of energies that are interacting. And when they interact, they produce a coherent whole, and we see only one version of them because our mind focuses in on a set of frequencies. Look, this should be obvious. If you accept the reality that remote viewing exists, then the next conclusion is that the multiple realities must also exist, because people can obviously, we've demonstrated this in countless experiments, can obviously remote view targets across space and time, in the sense that we can remote view things in the past without any problems. Now, if you can remote view something in the past, well, how did that happen? Obviously, the past has to still exist or you couldn't see it. The remote viewers saw what's there. So it's not like it's gone away and you're looking it up in a library. You're actually remote viewing the actual real McCoy. And so that past is invisible to you in your normal waking state of consciousness. But the remote viewer is trained to be able to do that. Well, if the past can be hidden from you and you're not bumping into it, then other versions of ourselves can be hidden from us and we're not bumping into that either.
Courtney, we've got about 30 seconds here. I want you to give your website out again.
Website is very important. We're a nonprofit, so it's Farsight, www.farsight.org, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far, .org, O-R-G. And there's two things that I really want people to do. First, sign up for our free newsletter, because that's the only way we get people to hear what we're doing, because what we do is we don't use any advertising. And secondly, if you really want to help us out, you can actually see one of the best things we've ever done, which is our new project, the Atlantis Project. Atlantis, the true story, and you can actually watch the first 15 minutes of the DVD, and it explains all the background right on our website. And then if you want to really help us out, if you purchase the DVD,
10 seconds,
that helps us do these projects, and the DVD is riveting.
All right, Courtney, sorry about that. Courtney, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's always fascinating. It leaves me wondering about a lot of stuff, and I'll think of a lot of questions, and I will get some in email as well. And I hope you'll be back with us very, very soon. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this evening. Remember, we are listener-supported. If you don't support us, we can't be here tomorrow. Find that donate button on our site. Keep us here. My friends, call